Our big thing here is, we have all that tech background and science and launch monitors. That's all here. But we're really focused on how you play the game. And there's no better way to play the game under pressure in a team environment with people trying to kick your ass.
This is The Tournament Code.
We appreciate you joining us. What we do at the beginning of every episode is kind of an icebreaker. Helps us ease things, and it helps us talk about our sponsor, PubView Books, and it's the PubView Books opening tee shot. And so what that is it's a quiz, not a long quiz. It's just a trivia question, and we try to cater it to our guests, make sure that it's answerable. So we're going to put you on the spot, see what you can do here. The question is two parts. So the first, it's about NCAA championships and your alma mater, SMU. Who was the last individual champion from SMU? That's the first one. I'll let you go ahead if you want to take that one.
That's DeChambeau.
Yep. And then SMU has won one team championship. What year was that in?
51?
1954, but very close. Good memory. Good memory. Well, we appreciate you coming on. As I said, Ryan, we are going to talk a little bit about your time at SMU, some about the FBI and fun stuff like that. First off, why don't you just tell people what you're up to right now?
Yeah. My official title basically is I'm the senior instructor here at Butch Harmon Floridian. I work with Claude Harmon. Claude Harmon, I believe is the best coach of our generation right now. He's won all four majors with three different players. He's given me the chance to coach here. He gave me the chance to start back in Austin. I'm basically the man behind the man. And basically my job here is to make everyone successful around me. I handle Claude's basically scheduling around the club here and help other coaches, Nico, Matt, and our team. And anybody else who wants to come into our gates, just try to help them be successful and whatever we need to do. So I just consider myself kind of a success coach. So whatever I need to fix, I'll fix. Whatever I need to coach golf-wise, I'll coach. I'm a big TBI guy with our fitness guy, Josh. And so, I think, one quick lesson for any golf instructor out there is to try to come up with not necessarily a job title, but a job that can transfer across multiple industries, multiple clubs. And you're not just the director of instruction of one club. You can be a coach to a lot of different styles of coaching and a lot of different styles of players in different areas of the world. So yeah, that's kind of me. I'm here in Florida. This is the golf capital of the world for professional golf. It's just been a great career move for me. Originally got here because my course in Austin burned down. So kind of a great, great sidestep. At the time I thought it was going to be over for me, golf coaching. And my last client in Austin was George Strait. And then got the call from Claude to start here in 2011. And it's been unbelievable since.
That is cool. When you say you do everything at the club, what is your schedule look like exactly, whether it comes to instruction? I know you got a lot of good players that you coach, especially junior players that you're working with, and then also just supporting everyone at the club.
Yeah, we got basically in Florida, for whatever reason, we got seasons here. And we basically have two seasons here. We have what I call the prime time season, which is basically U school, September-ish, through the end of Monday qualifying for the state of Florida. Typically, I think there's nine this year. And then everyone gets on their prospective tours and goes out and plays and comes back every once in a while, especially during the summer. But between like October, let's say October 1 through May 1st, typically is just straight tournament players. Maybe 98% of our business is tournament players, from junior, college, professional. We're just coaching. We're setting goals. We're doing screens. We're getting everybody ready for the next season. We're learning from the previous season. And here at the team facility, was a little bit different this year. We kind of created our own team, and that's been a great success on multiple levels. We're going to do it again this fall. And then during the summer, it's kind of my only time of year where I can actually breathe a little bit and hang out with the kids at home, wife, vacations, but it gives me a significant amount of time to work on my craft, to do podcasts with you guys, to keep on learning and help the guys that need help when they come in from the road.
So if I understand correctly, you guys have kind of created a team of players that all practice and play out of the Floridian.
Yeah. We've had a lot of conversations about what to call it. It's called Team Plobe, based on Floridian and Team Golf. But, you know, essentially what it is, it's special operations training for golfers. That's what it's come down to. And, in a team environment, I believe we can lift each other up. And, Coach Deacon, one of your guests earlier this year, had a real instrumental quote. It's on my phone, but, it was a lot of military type stuff. His dad was in the military, I believe. And, you know, I've had a lot of military, contact and support, throughout my career. And basically what it's come down to is we've been able to get a group of guys and girls, and we got two girls on the team, to create a team environment around their golf. And the idea is to lift everyone up. And versus a normal academy, which is an hourly-based instruction business, where there's no interaction between the players, or very little. We're in a team environment, a team facility, whether it's professional, like or professional sports, like the Mavericks, or the Cowboys, or the Rangers. Everyone around here has the same mission. And we've been able to kind of foster that and change the culture a little bit. And it kind of came about through LIV. They kind of put the accelerator on it. It also came through when I coached the high school team and took some elements from that. And basically we have four coaches here that run practice, run training. And some days it looks like football practice. Some days it looks like traditional golf practice. And it just gives us an opportunity. We basically sell out half of the day's schedule to the team, essentially. And we just have this group environment. So I wouldn't call it like a golf school. It's more like a team environment or a training environment. Or what we're kind of talking about this summer, it's kind of like special operations training for golfers.
So say if I was a member of Team Flow, what would a normal day look like for me?
Yeah, so this past season, we scheduled 20 hours of scripted practice, meaning that we basically had the schedule for the week sent out like on a Monday or a Tuesday morning, and Tuesday through Friday, we had our game plan for practice. Pros could be here basically for a couple hours or so in the morning to do their own thing. And then practice would start at 12 o'clock high noon on Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday. And essentially, either it was me coaching one day, I kind of did 2 days this year. One day was straight up playing some sort of competition on the course. Another day was short game. Another day was Nico Day, and Nico is one of our other coaches here, a great performance coach. He's part of a lot of lift teams and part of John Ron's team. And then we had Claude. Claude was kind of a Friday closer where we had a technique that we call round defense, which is basically how you defend your tournaments from the prior week amongst the group. And much like law school, Daniel, it's basically you're going up behind a podium and defending your case. And how either won the tournament or how he came in last or wherever it may be.
Very cool. One of the things that you mentioned there is early on is that I think Claude is the best coach of this generation, I think is how you phrased it. Tell us.
Look at the record, but if you're around him too, he's definitely the best. And then every 4 or 5 weeks a year, we got his dad Butch in here too. So it's like, ridiculous if you want to be a golf instructor to be a part of this circle. I'm very lucky.
Well, tell us what makes him so great working with players and how he can not just connect with players personally, probably, but also from a technical perspective, enhance them. And then from your perspective as a coach, what you've learned from him and how you apply that with your students.
Yeah. So for Claude, you know, he's grown up with a dad who's seen everything. So he's learned a lot from his dad and his family, his uncles, and their father, Claude, who kind of started the dynasty in 48 when they won the Masters. But the interesting thing with Claude is we're kind of like opposites in terms of, I'm a big math and science guy. He is if he wasn't coaching golf, he'd be an actor. He'd be an entertainer. He's that type of personality. He's an artist. But when you put kind of those combinations together, we're able to solve a lot of problems quickly and efficiently, whether it's golf, life, or golf swing, technical, whatever it is. We can do that on a team basis, working together. He can do it on an individual basis, working together or working with one of his players. And he just has a very vibrant and electric personality. And one of the Harmon genes is they are great storytellers. And if you've ever been around a Harmon, their voice carries several hundred yards, and we have studios here. You can hear them outside in the practice field if you're out there from the studio telling some sort of story or issuing some sort of challenge. And that really kind of resonates with the kind of the entertainment and fun part of taking a lesson. And then, you know, it's just, if you've listened to his podcast, he's a great speaker. He's a loud speaker. He's passionate about what he does. And you can just feel it when you're in the room with him and when he's coaching.
I know it's, I've heard Butch Harmon described as like the Yoda of professional golf, because players may not necessarily go to him for strict swing advice. They'll go to him, you know, to not really life advice, but, you know, how do I think on the golf course? How do I get my confidence back? Like, give me something other than just strict swing advice. Is Claude similar to his dad in that way? Or is he more so just like a really strict swing coach?
No, I think there's two types of coaches. You got swing instructors and you got a golf coach, like a college coach or a football coach. You know, we are big fans of other coaches and other sports too, but Claude knows it all. You know, Yoda, teaching Jedi for 800 years. Butch, he's been around golf since the early, when was he born? He's 80 years old, I think. So, you know, at least 75 years of golf with some of the best players of all time. So he's literally been around the best players of all time, including Tiger Woods. He's grown up with the likes of Ben Hogan, that generation. He's literally seen it all. And he just has this, Butch has this unbelievable gene where he just can just tell all those stories to the very little details to this day. And it's just a great experience when you're around him. And a lot of coaches kind of have that. It's a little bit of a rah-rah gene, you know, get you fired up based on some bad times or based on good times, you know. This coach has seen it all, and Claude's been right there with him for a lot of his career. And since 2011, he's kind of been on his own here with me and our coaches. And, you know, we're starting to have those stories from Brooks and DJ, and we're starting to pass those stories on to our players too.
You've seen a lot of stuff too, obviously. Let's kind of get into your past and how you ended up coaching. Starting off, you know, give us a quick rundown on junior golf, college golf, and everything after that.
I wasn't a very good junior golfer until maybe my senior year when I committed to really trying to win a state championship with my high school team. We had five great players. One of them is Matt Dobbins. He's probably the most successful from our team. He's won the club professional championship, I believe, twice. Almost won it a few weeks ago. He's played in like five or six PGA championships. He's a great pro up in the Met section. But yeah, you know, I played against Ryan Palmer growing up. He beat my ass every time. I played against Ed Lohr, a little bit older than me. He beat my ass every time. I just got beat all the time. And I think another lesson that I tell people is, you know, I probably made the wrong decision to play golf because I chose it too early. I was a lifelong swimmer. I decided to start playing baseball, a pony league, so 12, 13. And I decided to play golf because I wasn't as big as the other guys on the baseball team when I got to high school. I was a quick, pretty good hitter, and an excellent shortstop, second baseman. And they tried to give me the pitch, wasn't real fast, but I was just tiny. And I was probably 5'9", 130 as a freshman in high school. And so I grew fast, I was super skinny. And a lot of those guys did eventually get drafted. Some great pitchers, group. But I was always the smallest guy. I really didn't grow out until maybe college, freshman, sophomore year in college. So essentially I was intimidated, and I decided to go to a sport that I thought would be easy, and it definitely wasn't. And I tell the story that, and it's a, you know, you've interviewed Greg Rose. It's way more helpful to be a multi-sport athlete, to play golf as a junior, to have that multi-sport athlete background. And I had it, and I probably quit a little bit too early to play serious golf. So it took me a long time. I actually had a really decent senior high school season and a really good summer after graduating high school. And I ended up walking on at SMU, and Hank Haney was your coach. This is 1995. This is before he worked with Tiger. He was still a great coach at the time. Tour coach. He was probably a top 10 coach on Golf Digest back then. Mark Amira was his main player. And should have been a little bit more grateful back in those days, but he did give me a chance to play. And we had a pretty solid group of players. Hank Keeney came my sophomore year. He ended up winning the U.S. Amateur in 98. Chris Parra, the current coach of the SMU golf team, was on that team as well. Jim Skinner was a senior when I was a freshman. Ended up winning the last Southwest Conference individual title. So I was around a lot of great players, but, the story is that I went out and qualified for the tournament my freshman year, that first week of school, and Hank pulled me aside and said, "Hey, I know you played great. I'm not going to play you this year." And I was just kind of devastated. And we ended up kind of rebuilding my swings freshman year in college. I didn't play a single tournament. Had a pretty decent summer going into my sophomore year in college. Ended up playing one college tournament and shot like 73, 75, 78. And kind of over that Christmas break, I decided to leave the team and work on my next passion, which was, like we brought up earlier, I was on a mission to kind of work for the FBI. And so my college career was brief, year and a half, one tournament, not great. Should I have continued to play on that team? Maybe so, but I'm very thankful for my college experience. I loved going to SMU, wouldn't have it any other way. Had a great time there, great lifelong friends were made. And I'm still friendly with the guys on the team that I was crying when I left the team room that, I think it was like a Monday or Tuesday afternoon when that second semester started. I was crying. I couldn't even address the team. I had to run out of it. So it was a tough deal for me, but I knew at the time that there was something better for me. I was more passionate about it. But yeah, it's kind of like quick history. Junior golf and college golf.
What do you think allowed you to go from just basically picking the game up in freshman year of high school to being able to play on a big school's team like SMU?
I would definitely say I definitely trained the wrong way and made it a lot harder. If I had it back, I would be doing a lot of stuff. We coached today, much more training, much more athletic, much more competition and practice. And back in those days, I grew up in Austin, Texas. I was able to watch Justin Leonard and Ben Crenshaw a lot. And those guys were basically known for Ben known for short game and especially putting. Justin Leonard known for pretty much an all-around game, but he wasn't a long hitter. He just was great at everything. And now my game is essentially kind of modeled after those guys, and my strength growing up is short game. I couldn't really hit it anywhere until college. You know, I was just making up shots, just out-chipping and out-putting everybody. And there was no speed training. There was no working out. There was none of that. It was hitting golf balls and playing, which is still good, but you know, nowadays it takes a lot more to accelerate that growth process.
What was it like your freshman year to have your swing rebuilt with your coach? And what did you guys do to change it up?
You know, my swing was pretty natural. It was very flat, very short, growing up. And I believed in Hank and what he was doing at the time. I hit a low cut that flew like 230, 240. And Hank wanted me to start drawing it. He was known for creating draw style players. And we worked on getting my arms up. We worked on getting my body to kind of slow down a little bit and worked on a little higher finish, essentially. The component, though, that was introduced to me that year was working out. We had an assistant football trainer work us out. I think it was 3 days a week before the football team, so it was probably 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. And at the time, it was tough. It was a new thing for me to work out as hard as that. So we were sore all the time and didn't feel great all the time, and I probably weren't eating correctly, just being a normal college kid. Yeah, Hank, you know, was known for success with Mark Amira and a few other PGA Tour players. And I believed in what we're doing, and I did it. And I was able to kind of put away my desires to make an impact as a tournament player that year, just work on my game. And I stuck to it for, you know, at least a year, a little bit more, and just decided that, you know, I wanted to pursue college and college life and career after college.
I'd like to kind of get into what you decided to do after you left the SMU golf team and what factors went into that decision and kind of what specifically you ended up doing.
Yeah, so I was a political science major. I pretty much had my political science degree attained by the end of my junior year. So for that sophomore year, the rest of that sophomore year, junior year, I just went to school 18 hours a semester. And a good friend of mine, I joined a fraternity. It was more kind of an academic fraternity. Still probably a little bit. I mean, it is a fraternity. So I had a little bit of a normal life without going to golf practice for 30 hours a week or so in workouts. But I was really enjoying going to college and going to class. My favorite professor is Joe Kubilka. He's still there. We've talked every so often throughout the years. He's a political science, constitutional law expert. And my idea was to either go to law school or get a psych degree. And so I was basically done with college my junior year, and I had a little bit of a scholarship and had, you know, one more year left with all my friends. So I knocked out another degree my senior year, 18 hours a semester, I think 21 the first semester of my senior year, just to knock out a psych degree. And my intention was to probably go the psychologist route in law enforcement. I wanted to be a profiler for the FBI. And so I've got my degree. One of the things the FBI liked at the time was business experience, because late 90s is more of a 80s was kind of serial killer FBI stuff. 90s is a little more of accounting, junk bonds type stuff. A little bit of terrorism with the first World Trade Center bombing. But my intention was to get a little business experience. And I ended up taking a job with the Medicaid department in California, which was, it still is, the biggest Medicaid account for the federal government. And I quickly basically sat on the computer guy too. So I basically programmed out my job. And so I had nothing to do. But Monday morning, my programmer had completed my job for the week. And I sat right next to the fraud department. And so I kind of wandered in there, talked with those ladies, and worked on ways to catch the bad guys and worked on patterns to catch the bad guys. And that was pretty exciting. That was basically kind of late 99 through about 2000. Just trying to catch the bad guys, coming up with different software techniques. Late 90s, by the way. So we're not talking like fancy software. We're talking like desktop. We're talking JCL. We're talking really big mainframe computers type stuff. But even back then, a lot of the claims processing that you would have at a doctor's office is still electronic or scanned electronically. And so the bad guys typically had patterns, and we were able to identify those patterns. And I had a great time. I had a great time with that office and the Medi-Cal office in Sacramento. And it was a great time, great experience. And then the reason how I got back into golf was basically Paul Ory. And he kind of came for an American. He came out of nowhere and won the British Open that year. And it was a wild British Open. He had been a European tour player for a few years, but really no Americans kind of knew who he was. And that was a crazy British Open. And he came back from 10 shots. And I was like, man, if that guy can do golf or win the British Open, and I'm still playing golf and kind of shooting the same scores I was shooting in college in low 70s. If I give it a little bit of effort, and maybe I can do this thing. So for kind of the early part of 2001, I've really focused on playing golf. I still worked, and I committed to play the Golden Bear Tour down here in Florida in June of 2001. And saved up a ton of money, and definitely wasn't enough, but saved up enough of my own money, and my dad helped me out a little bit too, and I played the Golden Bear Tour down here, and got my ass kicked every day, didn't make a single cut. Chris Parra was down here, Ken Duke was down here. But yeah, that was a nice shot to the gut right there. Ended up going back home to Texas and played a few more years. Played on the Tyler's Tour, which is now the APT Tour. Unbelievable tour, great group of guys, still going. And ended up taking a job in Austin at Ben Crenshaw's club, Austin Golf Club. And that's where we hired Claude in 2005. And then basically the rest is history. I came out of the club pro business and went into the golf business when he arrived because of that personality. You know, he was just fun to be around. We brought in Graham McDowell. We're like, my gosh, he's this Graham McDowell guy. And a few years later, he won the US Open. And it was just electric. He went off to start his Dubai Academy. And I stayed in Austin, coached for a few years. And again, that coach or that course burned down in 2011, and he hired me here in 2011, and I haven't looked back since. So I've been coaching basically since kind of late 2005, early 2006, so almost 20 years, and still learning for sure. Trying to learn something new every day, change it up. But yeah, kind of the history right there.
Looking back at your golf swing in college, sounded like you made some changes towards hitting the draw. You just hit a low cut. And you made those changes and your golf game maybe got a little better, but it sounds like not much change. If you're going to go back and do things, one, it sounds like your practice habits, workout things would change with the information you have now. But two, what sort of technical changes would you have made to your golf swing?
I think what Hank gave me was definitely a lot more yardage. I probably went from hitting like 240 and mid 90s to probably by 96. I could probably carry a 280, the clubs back then. So back then that was far enough because I was able to hit it much higher with the high draw. I was using the copper-headed TaylorMade burners. You guys might be too young for those, but that was the hot thing back in the day. Ernie Els was playing it. It's huge to get the copper-headed versus the shiny finish. So those two heads were great. We used to kind of file them down and make them a little bit hotter. I grind it down. But the big thing, which I still use today, is in college, you're in a team environment. And so what Hank did for us, every week, we had 20 scripted hours because that's in the CAA rules. But we had play days. We had competitions. We had workouts before class. We basically had our script. And I carry that concept today and design scripts and programs for players. And that's the first real time I had a coach really kind of design or tell me what I needed to do based on what the team needs versus what I need. And so we still were able to have successful team practices, but it was more about getting the team ready for the next event, not necessarily me ready. And you still had to put in your own time to get my swing ready for all the changes I was making and little things like that. So one of the tricks he had was his academy was 45 minutes away from campus on the weekends. And he loved the schedule Saturday, Sunday practice beginning at 7 a.m. And so on paper, we'd have 20 hours a week, but the last 2 hours of the week was 7 o'clock in the morning at Hank's place, Saturday and Sunday. And that was tough. So we get up, leave at 6:15, get there for practice, and now it's 9 o'clock, and so what do we do now? So we ended up, you know, playing against each other on his little track when I was at his academy and hitting balls, and my parents had moved up to Dallas, so I took the team to my parents' house a bunch of times and had dinner, or lunch and dinner. And we just ended up practicing more at the time. And it was a way for him to kind of say, hey, you need to put in more hours. Because number one, you're just a walk-on. And number two, there's teams like back in the day, it was still kind of the same teams, Texas, Oklahoma State. Those guys are way better than us anyway. We're not going to catch up to them on a 20-hour-a-week basis. You have to put in more. And so at the time, it was really hard. Sucked some days, but now I understand why we were doing it. And I'm grateful because I still use those techniques and lessons today.
Let's talk a little bit about pattern recognition. It sounded like a pretty smart guy, did solid in school. As you said, a little bit more math and technical, like as far as how you like to process things, writing computer programs back in the 90s to do your job, all that kind of stuff. When it comes to instruction, who did we just talk to, Cooper? I don't know why I'm blanking on.
We talked to Mike Finney, Roberto Castro.
Mike Finney was talking with us about how he used to love the golfing machine. He was a golfing machine guy for a little bit. So I don't know if that stuff ever appealed to you. What was your philosophy instruction and getting guys to play better, again, from a technical perspective? And we'll also then dive into the team component as well in an organization.
Again, I'm very lucky in my career because I met Dave Phillips and Greg Rose in 2004, February 2004. TPI, you guys may know it today, is basically the greatest golf instruction manual out there of all time. And they essentially taught me the body swing connection, and that resonated with me as kind of a sportsy athlete growing up, knowing that I probably should have played more sports before I took on golf. And being able to, in 2004, do all the screens, kind of go down the rabbit hole, figure out what the body can do, and correlating with swing types, I had the game plan or the playbook laid out in front of me in 2004 because they did it to me. And they did it to me and several people that I brought in there throughout 2004 and 2005. And so that's how I started my golf instruction career. It wasn't Golf Machine. It wasn't reading golf books. I had no interest in that. It was more athleticism and about that body swing connection and being able to correlate, certain movements in a movement screen and being able to predict what they do in the golf swing was just like exactly what I love to do. And basically it's kind of solve problems, solve riddles, solve puzzles. And I've always done that as a kid, whether it's computers or trying to find the bad guys, find the patterns. But I was real lucky to have that break. And there's a lot of coaches like me, my age, I'm 46, that are part of this generation that I've had the TPI guys as a solid foundation. And then, you know, what Claude and Butch brought to me and other coaches is that, you know, how to play the game. Our big thing here is, you know, we have all that tech background and science and launch monitors. That's all here. But we're really focused on how you play the game. And there's no better way to play the game under pressure in a team environment with people trying to kick your ass. And that's essentially how you can take whatever game you have that day from the practice team to the course. And to me, that kind of unlocks the spriddle that golf has had forever. How can we get the game from the range to the course? Well, the range game is the course game is competition. So in playing golf, the range is not playing golf. And you know, it's like a basketball player having a bad game, and all he does is shoot free throws. The next, get ready for the next game. That's what golfers do. They set up their tripods, they hit one club, maybe two, he falls for hours. And that's not how you play, that's how you swing. So I've been around Claude and of course Dave and Greg, and my background basically is athleticism, solving the body, help us solve the swing. Solving the body first helps us solve the swings first or second, and then you know, just gamifying your experience playing golf. And that's how you take it from the range to the practice or to the course. You take it from the practice tee, where it's competition or some sort of gamified experience. That's what goes, that's what travels to the course.
Would you be able to be maybe a little more specific on some of those intricacies that you've picked up from the Harmons?
Something specific from the Harmons? Totally on the spot. I thought of it as, you know, a lot of it was Tiger Woods, which has shared a lot of stories with how he developed Tiger Woods. And Butch would challenge Tiger to do something. He would say, hey, you know, I've been working with Greg Norman, and, you know, Greg is just a pleasure. He can hit any shot he wants. And, I think when Tiger was growing up, he was more of a drawer of the ball. And there was one story with Butch where he just said, you know, there's a situation where he called for a fade. And like, Butch was like, you know, Tiger, I just want you to hit it over the tree because I know you can't fade it. And Tiger was like, what? So for whatever time it was, Tiger was like, I'm going to hit this goddamn fade around this tree. And that sort of like challenge was issued. And that's kind of the attitude that Butch had is, he kind of knew when, or has, he kind of knows when to challenge you and knows when to coach you and knows when to take care of you, to be a big hug. And so that's just people skills, right? So a lot of that is just people skills. So, I think a lot of instructors get kind of lost in the how and the technique and the data and all that stuff, but you can accomplish any shot with a lot of intent and a lot of will. And I think Butch can, and Claude and all the Harmon brothers, one of their secrets to success is that kind of outside of the data technique approach. It's their history, it's their experience being around all the legends of the game.
Let's talk about how you use the body first, you fix the body first, and then the swing, and which I think is what you just said there. And tell us the process for that. So I'm a student, I come to you, I want to play good tournament golf, and obviously you're going to look at my swing some, but what does it look like as far as testing the body, then improving the swing, and also making sure we're ready on the course?
Well, I'll go about it this way. You know, there's a lot of great tournament players that have terrible bodies and weird looking swings, right? And usually that swing is a product of that weird body, right? And so we would never want to dismantle that weird body if those tournament results are just awesome. What we want to do is, you know, learn how that body creates that swing and how we can keep that rolling for as long as possible, as long as it's not an injury-inducing type of move. And then conversely, you know, there's players that basically don't have a body to create the swing you're trying to emulate. So let's say, you know, it's Adam Scott, right? usually example number one of one of the prettiest things in golf. Well, Adam is an unbelievable extreme athlete. Like, he has got it all. He's strong in the right parts. He's mobile in the right parts. He can do anything he wants, right? So if you don't have that mobility or that strength with the same body type, if you will, as Adam Scott, we're not going to swing like that. I don't care who you are. If you do happen to have similar traits and similar body parts and similar muscles and similar mobility, then we might have a chance, right? We might have a chance. But the key thing with at least the TPI system is we can correlate what parts of the swing can work and what parts of the swing will not work. We can use 3D and all sorts of force and all that stuff, but we can also use the simple eyeball test too. When a guy comes in here and he's flushing it and he still can't play a tournament golf, you know, it's probably not a swing issue, right? It's probably a preparation issue. Maybe it's an emotional issue. Maybe it's a passion issue. So I try to, you know, use my psych degree and all my profiling education to help kind of decipher as quickly as possible, you know, what is really going on. Because I'm not going to change the guy's swing if he's hitting 100 straight balls out of the bucket and he hasn't missed one, right? It's like, what are we doing here at the range? What's happening on the course?
So at the point that you've decided, you know, this guy is swinging really well, he's hitting it really well, and there's something else we need to work on, what does the lesson look like from there?
Yeah, so if it's something else we need to work on, short game, whatever it is, you know, I'm going to take him basically through a playing test on the big course. Since it's more of a short game related issue, I'm going to take him on a short course. And we're just lucky to have two courses where I can do that. Or I can have some quick tests that I can use on the practice tee and on the short game areas and stuff. But I'm always going to test. And that's definitely one thing I learned from Greg. Now we're going to screen or we're going to test. And there's playing ability tests. There's short game tests we can do real quick. That are real easy. A good example would be, if I'm seeing you flush it and we got a short game issue, one of my quick tests is basically, I got 20 balls. I'm going to throw them down the practice tee. We're going to hit them to our short game green. And I'm just going to watch you do it. You can use whatever clubs you do. Use, I don't care, hit whatever shot. Basically, I tell them which pin to hit to, and I just watch. And the pit test is basically, can you hit the green every time? And I even do this for pros. And you know, if it lies in a divot, or if it's plugged in the bunker, because I do kind of take the last five or so balls and kind of make it a little more difficult if they didn't roll out where I wanted to. And my test is, can you get on the green every time? That's really the test. Because, you know, if you're a good player, you're probably going to hit, you know, three or four, you know, knee high or inside, give me your zone. You're going to hit maybe five or six within 8 feet. There might be a couple that are outside of 8 feet. And then what do you do with those last six, seven, five shots that are difficult? And the test is basically, get on the green. And they don't know what the test is. They think they're trying to get it close. And they're trying to hit the right shot or whatever it takes to get it up and down or the most impressive shot. But the test is really just get on green. Because we have some tournament or playing rules or tournament rules that we like to utilize here. And so that's a simple test. And I definitely have little putting games like that too and little iron games like that too. But definitely I like to utilize the testing more on the course where I can really kind of lock in a particular yardage that's awkward or a situation. We got a great playing course that Butch designed over here. It's just awesome. All types of shots you can make up, 150 in it. And part of our big philosophy here is driving. You got to be an elite driver. You got to be elite 150 in it. And there's a lot of data that backs up our belief. But quite simply, if you get on the green every time with a wedge in your hand, you're essentially an elite golfer. There's not enough pros can do it. 85%. Greens and red on approaches between 50 and 150 from the last year I looked. He's the best players in the world. We're still missing 15% of greens with a wedge up. So if we can at least elevate that to 100% at any scale level, you're becoming an elite player. So little tests like that, I'm always trying to do fact-finding. So yeah, fact-finding. If this is true, we do this. If this is false, we do that. So they both test like that.
I like that you said that, because I think a lot of people, especially junior golfers, have a misconception about what good golf looks like from a strategy perspective, especially one hitting greens from tough, like one tough spots. And a lot of that I think is because as a junior golfer, you don't play a lot of courses where you play a lot of courses that are pretty forgiving. So you miss in a certain spot and you'll at least like have a theoretical possibility. Whereas like, well, last week I was over a concession and the greens aren't like killer right now, like going fast. But even as is, there are spots that you hit it in where you're like right next to the green. And I was like, and I looked at it and I'm like, well, I can't even go anywhere near this pin. If I can just somehow get it onto the green from 20 yards away, this will have been a good shot. So they don't get tested with those. And then similarly, they think that every shot has to just be tight from 50 to 150 as opposed to being on the green, even being a good metric for success. Tell us how you work with students and get them to readjust their expectations so they can understand when they're actually succeeding.
Yeah. Number one, it's hard, especially with this generation, you know, the Instagram, YouTube generation that only sees the highlights, right? In our sport, you don't see the entire game, right? You watch a football game or a basketball game, you see the entire game. You see the ups and downs. You see the missed shots. You see the missed passes, the missed blocks. But in golf, just because it's, you know, over 18 holes and multiple acres of real estate, you just can't see every shot. Unless it's a major and you're following them on, you're following your favorite player on the app. So a lot of it is just educating, based on, you know, the shot like data, the data golf. I use data golf, you know, at least once or twice a week, looking at either his email or just how the last tournament went. You know, just educating, you know, a pitch shot from 125 to 18 feet, six paces right of the hole is elite. So if you're 25 feet, you're pretty close to elite, you know? And I tell you, if you're going to miss a green with a wedge, it's probably going to plug. And it's going to probably be in a short-sighted situation anyway. So if you miss a green with a wedge, it's like a shot penalty just to miss the green. And you guys watched the NCAA last night, Ohio State. Man, Ohio State and Vanderbilt first.
Yeah, those were great matches, great TV. It was awesome.
Really good to watch. I was texting the guys like, this is the perfect course and perfect skill level to watch in that course because there's stuff that can go wrong out there, but they also can hit some good shots.
Yep. So I was pretty partial to – I know Florida State's coach pretty well, Trey Jones, but I know Coach Mosley at Ohio State pretty well. We've sent some players to him. And that poor kid, Sabo, against Vanderbilt, he had a situation on 18 there, decided to use putter, and he didn't get it on the green twice, right? He got on the green third time. I think they cut away. And I'm like, that's a perfect example. Here's a kid on elite college who is maybe 10 yards off the green in a tough situation with a chance to advance, right, to the Final Four. And he chooses putter, safe play, I get it. But it doesn't get on the green. And I'm like, perfect example. Right? Perfect example. And then that other kid, Adam Wallen, he came down to practice with our team, with Max Motivan, March 14th, I believe it was. And I spent a couple of hours with him. And I knew who Max was. I didn't know who Adam was. And I watched Adam hit balls and flusher, right? And then Adam and Max kind of participated in a little competition on our short course. We played a worst ball scramble, I think it was that day. Basically, if you hit a good shot and your partner hit a bad shot, you're playing a bad shot, right? And came away telling Adam, like, he was a senior too, and Max is a senior. They're trying to get the PGA Tour U. Well, Adam, dude, you're good enough to do this, and you got plenty of time. And the season was okay, right? But it was just great to see him make that deciding point in the Vanderbilt match. Like, man, I just love that guy. And because he's finally realizing how good he was when he was here. And Coach Mosley said, that guy, Adam, he's just a savage in match play before the match play started. And he's like, man, Adam's playing great because he had a chance to win the title, the individual titles. Two strokes up with, I think, 10 holes to play. Didn't get it done, but I just told him, you know, proud to see Adam play well. And Coach Mosley says, I can't wait till he plays match play. He's a savage in match play. And he ended up beating Gordon Sharp on that last 19th hole. And I was just so fired up for that kid because, you know, that kid went through kind of a gauntlet here for the couple hours. You went with, you had him here, hard stuff. And college golf was tough. And he just finally blossomed at the right time. And I was pretty impressed to see. I mean, he almost pulled it off not to win, get a trophy for eighth place or whatever it was, and then show up the next day. Now it's time for team golf. That takes a lot, you know, a lot of energy and a lot of passion too to, you know, turn off that individual title loss and go out there and play Gordon Sargent, who's basically number one, number two amateur in the world right now, and beat him, right? So that was a great example of, you know, a kid who's developed in Coach Mosley's system at Ohio State, and can't be more thankful for him sending his players down and playing in our tournament and learning from coaches like that.
Yeah. No, Coach Mosley's done well up there. We know a few guys that have played up there and have had them on the podcast, Neil Shipley and John Eric Alford. John Eric and I have known each other for a while. It was interesting too with Sabo, that putt on 18. I think, I can't remember if it was 17 or 16, but had a similar situation, I'm pretty sure, where he was, I don't know if you saw that one, similar type of shot. And he putted up, it went up, and then came back down into the water behind him. Yeah, I can't remember which hole it was, but it was one of those things when I saw it happen again on 18. I was like, man, I've been there, made that mistake, but that's the one mistake you can't make out of that spot, is not getting it up there. And I get why you do it, because that's a tough shot from down there. Tough lies too. Yeah,
I think the flip side, I think I don't know if you guys saw the Jackson Koivin kid off the green when he was able to take that drop. I mean, he was probably 5 or 6 yards off the green, but he went ahead and took putter, just got it up there nice and tidy. But, you know, made the veteran play, which was cool to see because he's 18 years old, I think.
Yeah, I think
he's right. A freshman.
Yeah. I think the quick and easy rule for short game is get a shot to within 8 feet. Because that's basically a 50-50 make on a PGA Tour. If you get it to, you get a putt off the green to 8 feet or so, that's elite enough. Right? Give yourself a 50-50 chance to make the putt. Yeah. And for that Sabo kid, he did bounce back in the second match against Auburn. I think he won his match, in that afternoon match last night. He did bounce back to win, but, man, I was just killing myself. I mean, he's like, just take an 8-iron, something, I don't know what it is, get it on the green first. But I think that his opponent was on the green first. I think he was only 3, and he was short of 3. At least give yourself a chance to par, because the tie is all we needed to advance. And then Walden ended up making par, and Sargent made the bogey on their playoff ball. So that was all good for the team to advance.
Yeah, it was great to watch. It'll be fun to see some today. The last question we ask every guest is the same. And for you, we'll do it in two parts. One, if you could go back to yourself as a junior golfer and tell yourself just one thing, what would that one thing be? And two, if you could tell a junior golfer just one thing, what would that one thing be?
I would have told myself to get back in the baseball team. Keep going for, you know, that freshman, sophomore year. Work out with the team, ride the bench, whatever it would be. Learn how to play in a team environment. Learn how to win. Learn how to lose and cope with losing. Learn from those bigger kids what they're doing. Because they were all straight up athletes that got drafted, right? So, which was what I tell our juniors today. I don't want to coach you until you're at least 16. You can drive up here by yourself and you have played other sports. You can go work with anybody and they're all great. But right? In order to work with me, I need an athlete and I need someone who's got that driver's license, right? And that's a big step for a kid. It may sound trivial, but man, I'm telling you, that is a big step for a kid to get that driver's license. And that sort of responsibility that comes with driving can we joke about it with Paul all the time. It's like, some 17 or 18 year old girl has to get driven in with their mom or dad. And we're like, what are you doing? You're 18 years old. Get a damn license. Do this. And it just makes a difference in terms of being responsible for your life and your game when you get that license. But I think that covers that question for you, right?
Yep, absolutely. Where can people find you on social media, reach out to you, all that fun stuff?
Yeah, so you can reach out to me essentially on Instagram or our website. So I'm just Ronnie Chrysler on Instagram. Our team account is teamflow_BHF on Instagram. I'm not going to respond to that one, but you can kind of see our tip of the cap to what we did this past season. And then our website is BitchHarmonFluidian.com. We don't use the phones here anymore. Brooks finished the phones off for us. When he won the PGA, should have won the Masters, but when he won the PGA, we went to an application-based process to work with us. And so our application is still up online right now, and I'm probably a month behind applications. So there's probably 6 or 7 a week, so 30 a month that I kind of sort through. And that's basically how you can work with us, or you can maybe take a putting lesson or get fit for something here at the club during the summer for sure. But yeah, for all the serious tournament players, we do want them to apply, tell us why, give us some history, some references. And we're to a point in our career here, based on Claude's success and Brooks' success and DJ's success, where we can pick and choose who we want to work with. We're a member-based club, so we always got our members and stuff, but the majority of our coaching is tournament players. So you got to really appeal to us. You got to write that resume, basically, when you apply to us. And that's at BitchHarmonFluidian.com, and you can hit apply. And I'll get to you one day, but don't expect it to be quick.
Excellent. Well, be sure to check out Ryan. Be sure to check out Floridian. As a reminder, you find us on Instagram at @TheTournamentCode, Twitter/X @TournamentCode. If you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, please like, subscribe, leave a rating, all that fun stuff. As always, we appreciate you taking the time to join us and look forward to diving in deeper to what it takes to play elite tournament golf.